We're speaking with John Lee Anderson, longtime staff writer for The New Yorker magazine and biographer and journalist in Latin America and around the world. Welcome to Third World View.
Thanks, Norm. It's great to be back with you.
Great to have you on. Now, you just returned from Cuba. You were down there during the visit of U.S. President Barack Obama. And so I want to talk today a little bit about what Cuba is like today. Fidel Castro, of course, has been out of the public spotlight for quite a while, and yet certainly his presence remains strongly felt there. You had a piece in The New Yorker just after President Obama left. It was called Cuba After Obama Left. And it starts by talking about President Obama's speech in Cuba, which I watched live and was impressed, among other things, that he referred to the civil rights movement as a social movement, which you don't usually hear coming from the mouth of a U.S. president. But let's start there with President Obama's speech in Cuba. What was your impression, and what were the impressions of the Cubans that you spoke with there?
Yeah, Norm, it was an extraordinary moment, and I really did feel, in this rather cynical time in which we feel we've seen and heard and done everything, I felt I was witnessing a very historic moment, and that the speech was really up to the occasion. I'm not one to gush about political speeches, but this one was up there, I felt. He touched all of the high notes of history, moved, as you saw, very smoothly from English into Spanish. The Cubans really love that, by the way. Every time he would say something colloquial about Spanish, it was like winking at them, and they loved it. It was interesting, though. I had a woman seated next to me in the theater who was all elbows and feet, and I didn't really realize why until after the speech. She turned out to be a correspondent Cuban for Telesur, the Venezuelan channel, which beams, how should we put this, sort of an anti-U.S. message throughout the hemisphere. It is the kind of counterpart to, I guess, our Fox television, But anyway, I thought that she was just clumsy, but I realized later that she was probably intentionally elbowing me and just being rude. It was the kind of dissonant note. And then someone recognized me, a Latin American journalist, and came up and asked me to give a little, a few remarks into his iPhone. And she got up and walked between me and the camera three times in the course of about 2 minutes. So I realized after, I was kind of scratching my head, and I realized later when the reaction started from how, the Cuban Orthodox conservatives, the hardliners in the party, and for that matter, Telesur, the Venezuelan channel, the kind of churlishness with which they had received the speech and the skepticism with which they expressed their views on pretty much anything coming from the U.S., it was very dissonant to the atmosphere in the theater itself, I have to say. I was seated not far from President Raul Castro. He was in the gallery above me alongside Prima Ballerina Alicia Alonso. And he was beaming throughout and stood up when Obama finished and left the stage. He stood up and gave the two-fisted salute, victory salute. And people around me stared to him, clapped, and shouted, Viva. And I interpreted that, as I wrote, as a kind of recognition of his shared role in this historic moment. So it was odd. After that, there was a few days in which people, I noticed, didn't really express their views in Cuba. They were keeping their powder dry. But because on the nightly television show, very much run by the party, Mesa Redonda, it's the round table. It's a kind of, slanging match kind of crossfire type of thing, except it's usually absent people that are getting hit. And in this case, it was the U.S. and then a few editorials in Granma, the Communist Party Daily, expressing this kind of skepticism, this, oh, you come and you're nice guys now, but what about all the history, blah, blah, blah. And I was wondering what this meant, because, of course, it's very dissonant with what Raul Castro has said repeatedly ever since he announced on December 17th, 2014, along with President Obama, that they were putting history to one side in order to get on with a new relationship. So this kind of let's go back and rub salt in the wounds, let's dig open the blisters and examine the sores, again, kind of attitude, struck a note of dissonance. And it was difficult to know how to interpret it because, you know, one tends to think of societies like Cuba's as monolithic. Of course, they're not. But what did this mean? Did this mean that there were independent voices that were in disagreement with Raul Castro? Finally, the day I left, Fidel Castro, the older brother, who, as you said, has been retired for several years and is older, coming up to 90, and isn't seen much in public, wrote a letter to Grandma, which was a full-page letter, on the one hand, defying, you know, the periodic conjecture that he's dead or gaga, and two, because it was unmistakably him. You know, it was long-winded, it was kind of discursive, it made its own points. It was very much Fidel Castro. And in which he expressed that kind of churlishness. And it was interesting. He called it, you know, Brother Obama, and it was kind of acid. And he said, so Brother Obama has come here, you know, an African-American, and he goes off on a soliloquy about how the Cubans had helped fight the apartheid regime in South Africa and Angola, and where were the Americans then? But now you come here and you want to be our friends. Well, he concluded by saying, we don't really need your charity, Mr. Imperialist. You know, it was a kind of, and so a conclusion, to make a long kind of anecdotal response to your question, to bring it to a close, this was, you know, there is a core rump in the party. A lot of them are older people. I would say between about 60 and 90, you know, Fidel's age. The people who either fought in the revolution, the people in her now essentially like our World War II veterans, or perhaps even, you know, Korea. And those who came immediately afterwards, who spent their entire careers at the service of the revolution, and are in their late middle age, or they're beginning to be elderly people, and they see their society transforming, both because of Raul's decision to open up to the market to a degree, the increased tourism, and now the rapprochement of the Americans, and they're confused by what they see, and they feel afraid, and they feel afraid of change. And so they're striking out. And I think Fidel expresses, however, something that's very current in that generation, which is, and maybe it's the bottom line with the old revolutionaries, for all the fact that they embraced socialism, it was always really a revolution about national sovereignty and about pride. So that's really what Fidel was saying. He was saying, look, you know, don't think you can come back in here just because we look a little threadbare and we need all your stuff. We've managed before and we'll manage. You know, it was kind of national pride. And, you know, and so does that, you know, I was trying to make sense of it in the piece I wrote. Does that mean that that things will slow down, that Raul will have to, you know, in acknowledgement of his older brother's distrust you know, skepticism, is he going a little bit slower than he could have? Yeah, I think a bit, yeah. I think he's going faster than his brother would like. And I think he's going a little bit slower because of his brother. I think it's one of those things. I don't think anything's black or white here. I think what you see is what you get. Raul, you know, early on in their lives was the militant, even the extremist, and he's turned out to be a more pragmatic guy than his brother. Fidel, in power for so long, an iconic figure, by any stretch of the imagination, has found it difficult to simply be an old man sitting on his front porch, and wants, and when he can, uses that iconic status to express his opinion. So what I think we'll see from now on is more of the same, but we're in an interesting moment where it's about to come up to the 7th Communist Party Congress. These happen every 6 years. it's an important moment. At the last one, it was when Raul announced these reforms, which have included the permission for Cubans to buy and sell property, to travel, to open businesses, and so on. Now, we'll see whether he goes full blast forward or puts on the brakes a little bit because of these dissonant voices by the conservatives within the party, but because of the fear of loss of control, perhaps, by the party, not only political, but maybe cultural. There's also, you know, a kind of existential fear of being overwhelmed by the Americans in the way that we tend to have of overwhelming everybody, you know. So it's a very interesting time. That party Congress is coming up in about 10 days. And we'll see on the other side of it. It lasts a week or so. What's going to happen in Cuba? The pace of change, or, you know, whether the momentum's going to increase or slow down. I suspect we'll see a kind of middle road adopted, in which certain things are held back and other things are pushed forward. But let's see.
You know, you talk about this cultural overwhelming, and of course that may very well be one of the things that the old party folks are concerned about, because you see what happens when the U.S. products flood a market. You know, you have all the plastic things suddenly showing up in all the stores and so on and so forth. And I worry also about some of the traditional kind of cultural sites. The one that comes to my mind, of course, is the bar that Ernest Hemingway used to go to. And I remember, you know, little bits of graffiti on the wall and things like that dating back to Hemingway's time there. And you just wonder what's going to happen to all of that sort of uniquely Cuban heritage as the flood of tourists begins to come to the island.
Yeah, very true, Norm. I mean, you know, you're already seeing, you know, any place that tourism goes in a massive way, it tends to empty out the local patrimony. You know, the local heritage tends to become, especially in countries that are small and have no real other source of income, practically speaking, than tourism, they really have no choice. So their local, you know, sights and sounds and heritage tends to be turned into something that can be monetized at the service of the tourists who come. So whether it's their songs and dance, or their, you know, their buildings, the way they're portrayed, and their heritage, it's been happening for some time in Cuba. Cuba is a very attractive place. It's the world 60 years ago. For Americans particularly, this is the place where people's parents, or say grandparents, went for romantic weekends back anywhere, anytime between the 30s and the late 50s. This is America, because it's our Chevys, you know, it's our Studebakers, and it's our romantic memories of an America before the JFK assassination, before Vietnam, you know, before the American dream turned bad. Somehow, Cuba is literally the kind of physical embodiment of the golden period of the American dream, you know. And so I think it has an unusual ability to bewitch outsiders, and especially Americans. This is a country that has seen no highways, no strip malls, no chain stores, no suburbia, none of the, I would say, destructive forces, you know, modernity, that have so altered the shape and the face of the United States in the last 50, 60 years. It doesn't have that. We, of course, and most of us who see this place, it might be distressed and needing a paint job, but it's a very charming reminder of a world of yesteryear in which children played on the street. There wasn't much crime. There were hardly any cars. Neighbors swapped gossip on their front stoop. The pencil sharpener or the knife sharpener and the newspaper vendor still wandered down the streets calling out in funny voices their products. You know, this is very charming to us. We've lost it entirely. And of course, I mean, all of us who know Cuba, irrespective of whether we are more or less critical of what happened in the revolution, can see this and would love to see it somehow preserved. And there are people working there in Cuba and outside to see that as much of that happens as possible. And I know that Fidel was always very down on tourism and tried to limit it as much as he could. In the 90s, after the Soviet pullout, there was a limited embrace of tourism because they had no choice. And Fidel ensured that most of the tourism went to these kind of all-inclusive sort of keys, offshore places. A little bit apartheid. He tried to keep the tourists away from the population. It wasn't entirely successful. But the kind of tourist resorts as such as they exist in Cuba are mostly on these little sand spits of beaches, you know, connected by causeways to rural airports in Cuba. You have seen tourists in Havana, but you never felt overwhelmed by it. That's all begun to change this past year as, on the one hand, you had Americans surging in, doubling in numbers, and you had everybody else trying to get there before the Americans, as they say, ruined it. That, sadly, is our image in the rest of the world. And that was pretty much everywhere I've been in the past year. I've heard so many people say it to me. I've got to get there before McDonald's arrives, before you guys ruin it. That's the kind of impression. It's more a recognition of the almost inevitable juggernaut, economic and cultural, that the United States represents when it comes anywhere. So these are some of the challenges the Cubans face. How much of that are they going to take? How fast do they go? How can they control the society? Amongst its other virtues, and I'll end on that, Norm, so you can ask me something else, is that it is probably the safest society in the Western Hemisphere. And that's a statement of fact, not any kind of, I'm not a fellow traveler. It is the fact. You can, as a woman, you can walk across Havana and probably between 12 and night at 3 in the morning, and nothing will happen to you. There are no drug gangs. There is very little in the way of drugs. The penalties are really harsh. Most of the states surrounding Cuba are either failed states because of drugs and drugs transshipment economies, or failed or actual narco states. I mean, Mexico is arguably now a narco state. Cuba is not. And personally, this is something I would love to see them preserve somehow. How do you do that? Or is the global market that we represent, that we exemplify, also mean that inevitably they also have to take, our drug economy with them? And these are, I think, very serious concerns and things which are not really being discussed too explicitly, openly right now. But I think, should be and probably will be soon. Because that is also one of the reasons why Cuba is unique. It is unique for that reason. It is a safe country in which, by and large, it has also missed out, thankfully, on the the ravages of the narco culture in all of its transmogrifications.
You touch on this issue of things that Cuba has to offer us, and I want to expand on that a little bit, because certainly, after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc, Cuba was forced into rethinking its economy and also rethinking its agriculture. And you had this huge development of the technologies of green agriculture, way beyond integrated pest management. And then you also have some of the medical advances. I've seen recently articles about, Cubans' work on cancer, and I personally witnessed some of the transplant surgeries that they were able to perform. Those kind of things are things that they have to offer to us. Will our country be able to take those and learn from them without trying to take them away?
Good question, Norm. President Obama has spoken to these things too. I know that it's contemplated that some kind of exchange. He's certainly recognized these advances. These are valid advances. These are valid areas in which Cubans can really contribute. And I think he and the team that has supported the policy to end the embargo, to normalize relations, are trying to see ways in which they can help channel resources or empower parts of the Cuban economy that will allow it to continue on in a kind of more diversified and potent way, including biomedical research, healthcare, the famous, you know, internationalist doctors that go all over the world that are seen of real utility to countries around the world, and in their education system, which has provided a solid base of education. However much it's suffered from disinvestment, it's there in a way that really very few other countries in the Western Hemisphere, including parts of the United States, have. You know, so these are all things in which I think, you know, it's heartening for me. It's been heartening for me to see that President Obama has once and again remarked on these things, that these subjects have been part, the ones you point out, part of the bilateral discussions that have been going on all year. We don't tend, as the public, we don't tend to hear too much about these other than the kind of dry, you know, summaries or of reports given by either State Department officials or even drier in Cuba. But, you know, all of this is part of a kind of coming together between our states at the official level and not official in a variety of ways that I think can only be positive. So I think what can I say? You know, let's see. But I would say there's at least a fighting chance that Cuba's advances in these areas will be recognized and compensated, and they will allow them to. We will allow them to continue to retain control of these things, assisting them in their efforts to remain a sovereign state, which is, of course, the raison d'etre, as I said at the beginning of the revolution. I think something that's key, you know, desperately important for Cuba's conservatives, particularly, and its older people. And it is, by the way, because of its healthcare system, it suffers from an aging population in much the same way that some of the better social democracies in Europe has, you know, and the kind of big question of how are we going to fund them in their old age? You know, the pension funds just don't, you know, didn't contemplate people living to 100 or whatever it is. So actually, you know, we're really talking about by and large, an aging population. I'm not quite sure of the statistics, but it's a lot of people that are older, and therefore, you know, their concerns need to be addressed. And the main concern, I would say, is that their social welfare system be guaranteed, not be thrown out like the baby with the proverbial bathwater. And you know, and we as a you know, vastly more powerful and economically richer neighbor can both help them in that, possibly, by being very careful about our footprint, and also learn from it, you know, and benefit from it. As you pointed out, you know, they have made advances in eye surgery, including night blindness, retinitis pigmentosus. They have done a lot of research and they work on vitiligo, the skin discoloration. They've got major breakthroughs in medical areas in orthopedics, I think in pediatrics as well. And I'm probably missing a few things. And so on, you know, as well as in the biomedical area, the actual production of medicine. So these are all, you know, these are all, and they have devised a way. They have created a culture which doesn't really exist anywhere, in which people are educated by the state as doctors and then are willing, actually have enough of a sense of social service that they're willing to go off for 2 or 3 or 4 years to really remote, in some cases, impoverished parts of the world. In return for, yes, they earn a little bit of money that they wouldn't earn back home, but we're not talking much. A lot of it is about social service. They've actually created, you know, a cadre of a medical cadre that cares about people. And that is an extraordinary thing. And I think, you know, probably as a lot of Americans, we get pretty cynical about that. Occasionally you meet the great family doctor, but there's a lot of them that you feel are, you know, getting rich at our expense. And I think that's something that, you know, Cuba has yet to see. And let's hope that they can maybe... you know, that what they've managed to do with their doctor corps is something that can be learned again, that idea of service, public service, by other countries.
And of course, in his speech, President Obama mentioned the Cuban doctors working on Ebola, and we had an interview here with a friend locally in Madison who was there in Sierra Leone working with Cuban doctors in an Ebola clinic. So we know that story.
Absolutely.
Here in Madison as well.
This is one of the ways in which the Obama administration and the Castro government, made real efforts to work together, that we, our American military personnel and Cuban doctors worked side by side in Liberia and Sierra Leone. And this was something they did quietly, but I think both sides are rather proud of. It showed that they can work together in practical ways. And I think they're also looking at other ways in which their professional corps on both sides, including our Coast Guard, anti-narcotics, and so on, can work, and scientists, as well as doctors, can work side by side in very practical ways that kind of lift the whole Cuban-American relationship from the ideological, from the old days of polarization, from the political, and into, as we've seen everywhere else. I mean, we don't get along very well with Vladimir Putin's Russia, but our astronauts and their cosmonauts have managed to continue to work together. So I think we're looking at ways in which we can increase the capacity for bilateral cooperation and friendship, and that's a good thing.
I was thinking of the sort of lost opportunity of the images of the U.S. and Soviet troops shaking hands in Europe during World War II, how that promise did not continue. There was a cartoon that was going around I thought was very good, where it had a picture of President Obama speaking in Cuba, and he says Cuba should free all political prisoners on the island, and then image of President Raul Castro saying, "Well, I'm afraid we don't have jurisdiction over Guantanamo, Mr. President." And this is a question: what
exactly
happens?
Very good.
What happens
very
with
good,
Guantanamo?
Well, President Obama will continue to try to close the jail itself within the base. It doesn't look like he's going to pull that off before he leaves office, but he's trying to create a kind of momentum, I think, in fact, on the ground that will at least make it obvious that that's happening. And I don't think he was particularly assisted there, from what I hear, by the Pentagon and other parts of the kind of entrenched military intelligence bureaucracy that opposed his plans and kind of went on a go slow strike for 7 years. But he's not also helped by the fact that many of the countries of origin of these guys that are in Guantanamo don't want them back. And also harmed by the fact that some of those who go back, go back to terrorism. And so it's a really contentious one. And sadly, the black hole was opened back in the Bush years. I mean, that's how it all started, as you know. But, beyond that, of course, it's for the Cubans. This is just a win-win. All they have to do is say Guantanamo, and the Americans cringe, because what had been a kind of forgotten military base acquired by Cuba after the Spanish-American War over a century ago, and which they can just hang on to in perpetuity, but it was long been a sore point for the Cubans, of course, because it was handed over by a kind of vassal regime, back in the days of the Panama Canal and all of that. Now they're probably in much, much closer to actually seeing that base return to them than ever before. What can the Americans say when they say Guantanamo? Well, they think about the prisoners, and they think about the kind of fact that most people in the world, if they've heard about it, have heard about Americans behaving in a kind of criminal nature in a place like that, abusive jailers of people. So I think probably as the relationship goes forward, you will see, for all the fact that Mr. Obama is saying that it's not on the table now, it's clearly going to be on the table for the Cubans. And if it's Mrs. Clinton who takes the presidency or Bernie Sanders, I'm just being an optimist here. Anybody but Ted Cruz or Trump, of course, takes the presidency. I would hazard a guess that they're going to have to deal with and very possibly begin negotiations, much as we saw under Carter with the Panama Canal, to transfer sovereignty of Guantanamo back to the Cubans. I don't see how we have any real argument in this day and age, in the name of good neighborliness and these new relations with Cuba, of not doing so. So I do see that as a very likely thing down the road, you know, in the next 10 years, perhaps.
John Lee Anderson, staff writer for The New Yorker, joining us here on Third World View. And I want to close by talking about your current project, which is a biography of Fidel Castro. And you have done other biographies of world leaders, some of them living, some of them not. Tell us a little bit about the Fidel Castro project, since he is still living. First off, you know, are you worried about getting him mad at you and not wanting to participate in the project? but also, you know, how do you go about doing this?
I wake up every day, Norm, thinking, usually with anxiety attacks, that Fidel has either died or, you know, or I have sometimes, you know, something like, you know, joyous dreams in which, you know, we're sitting there talking. And he's telling me his life story. What can I say? You know, this. I'm just doing it. And I can't get too worried about the fact that he might die or get upset or this or that or the other. You know, I wrote a biography of Che Guevara. He was already dead. I managed to do that. It's a big project. It's one that it's been on my plate for a long time. I've already got a lot of work done. I hope to continue to be able to go forward. It's like all the things I seem to take on, it's not an easy one, but that's about as much as I'd say. What I would say at the end, in terms of the actual project itself, it's a toughie, but, there's no one, you know, much as I said about Che when I was doing it, there was no one in the world at the time I was more fascinated by than Che Guevara. And I would say that is true of Fidel Castro, you know, and when I finally decided that that's what I would do, he's dominated my life in many ways. He's been there throughout. He's a fascinating figure. For all the reasons that we know, he touches most of the inalterable memories of the Cold War. Personally, he tells us the story of the last, my God, now nearly century of human existence in a kind of dramatic way in which he played a very crucial role that we have still yet to come to terms with. You know, what will history decide about Fidel? Was he a villain or was he a hero? Was he both? These are the kind of things I'm grappling with and which I find fascinating. And I think, in a sense, is the kind of thing we as Americans have to come to grips with now, too, as our relationship and our sense of the Cubans evolves. After all, in the last year and a half, what has the American president done? He has recognized a foe. And we are now becoming friends. That's an extraordinary process, not one that happens very often. It's very historic. And Fidel Castro is right at the heart of that story.
John Lee Anderson, staff writer for The New Yorker. You can read his recent piece, Cuba After Obama Left, at the website newyorker.com, and all of his books and other writings available through the Internet and through local bookstores as well. Thank you so much for joining us today on Third World View.
Norm, always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Guajiro que labra la tierra. Se oye allá en la lejanía el llanto del guajiro.